Okay, hi everyone. This is Nasir Gami. Thank you for joining me on the live stream here today. Let me mute myself. Okay.
Hi, Dr. Gami. I think you may have the live stream open.
Okay, sorry. I think I had a technical glitch there. You probably couldn't hear me. So hopefully you can hear me now. Nasir Gami, and we're doing our second podcast. That's a live stream. If you have any comments, please put it up on the live stream tab. This live stream will be about the SM, and I'm just going to give a little talk to you about it, a conversational, just what I think. And feel free to, again, comment and ask questions. My colleague, Dr. Daniel Herringer, helped me with arranging this, and he also suggested some questions that might be one way of kind of having this discussion. So one of the things that I say is that DSM is mostly false. I even give a specific percentage, 95%. And the one way to start this discussion is to say, why do I say that, and what do I mean by 95%? Well, the concept of falsehood really reflects the scientific term validity, which means, are the DSM concepts real, valid? Do they actually exist in some way in the real world, in the biological world, in the psychological world? And there is a definition of this in medicine and in psychiatry. In medicine, the definition is that you have symptoms, but you connect those symptoms in some way to pathology or some abnormality in the body. In psychiatry, we don't have blood tests or autopsy pathology that we can use as in medicine. Instead, we talk about different lines of evidence that point in the same direction other than symptoms to support the concept that certain symptoms are a legitimate disease or diagnosis. And that we have three other lines of evidence besides symptoms. One is genetics or family history for diseases that are genetic. Another is the course of illness, meaning whether the symptoms happen a certain kind of way versus another, their age of onset, if they're young versus older, if they occur as episodes, which have a beginning and an end, and then are recurrent and come and go, or if they're chronic, the symptoms are there all the time, and then you continually have them. They might gradually get worse, for instance, as in dementia. So the course of illness is another validator, the third one after genetics and symptoms themselves. And then the fourth validator is treatment effects, which can be nonspecific, but sometimes useful, or biological markers if we have them. So if you ask the question, is the diagnosis valid in psychiatry? Is it legitimate? Is it real in some way? What you're saying is, do those symptoms differentiate from other diagnoses or normality, not just based on the symptoms, but based on genetics, course of illness, and treatment effects or biological markers? And if you ask that question of the 400 or so DSM diagnoses, we have evidence of validity based on genetics, course of illness, treatment effects, or biological markers, only in maybe a dozen, and by two dozen maybe if you stretch it. and good evidence of validity, meaning replicable data that's pretty good, that a lot of researchers would agree with, maybe in just a dozen or so. And even there, there's always a little bit of disagreement, but at least there's some evidence. Now, one way of putting this is to say we don't have evidence of validity in 380 out of 400 diagnoses. There's your 95%. Another way of putting it, though, is, and this is the, I think, in a way, the cynical way that the DSM has developed. Some people talk about the black hole of validity, meaning even when you do validity studies, people will sometimes disagree on what the data mean or how we should interpret them. I think that's cynical because all of science is like that. You have data, you'll have interpretations, there will be some disagreement. That doesn't mean you just throw up your hands and say science is useless, let's just make things up, which is essentially what DSM has done. So let me explain that. What do I mean by DSM has made things up? From the very beginning, 95% or so of DSM diagnoses have been based on just the consensus opinions of experts, and I keep using air quotes because sometimes they're really not experts in the field. Sometimes they're just administrative leaders of the American Psychiatric Association or chairman of departments who may have academic power, but they're not necessarily researchers who are expert in what they're talking about. But anyway, these people get around committee rooms and make decisions, and with a majority vote, we'll say, let's define diagnosis X this way, diagnosis Y this way, and diagnosis Z that way. That's not based on any scientific research. It's not based on validity data. It's not based on strong scientific evidence. And in fact, the DSM leadership over the years has admitted this. The leader of DSM-3, the third edition in 1980, which was the big radical change that gave us what we have now, was Robert Spitzer. The leader of DSM-4, Alan Francis, 1994. And then DSM-5, the fifth edition, and the current one, 2013, was led by David Kupfer. Of these leaders, Dr. Francis, for instance, has admitted that he calls for pragmatism and says that pragmatism is the main way to make revisions in DSM. And by that, he means that we just decide what's best, what we think is best for the profession, for society, for patients. That may sound reasonable, but he says that that should be put ahead of scientific data. And that was really the way with the very beginning with DSM-3 in 1980 that Spitzer approached this as well, because they said, look, we don't really know what causes psychiatric illness, so we're just going to give up on validity. And they make another mistake here. They think that you have to know causes or etiologies to be able to have valid diagnoses. The vast majority of medical diseases are such that we do not know their causes. We don't know the cause of diabetes, high blood pressure, asthma, migraine, but we can validly define them. In psychiatry, it's the same. And psychiatrists have, again, sort of cynically, I think, used the issue of not knowing causes to not try to be valid in their diagnoses. So Spitzer and DSM-3 gave us 292 diagnoses. 2 years before the research diagnostic criteria, which were based on diagnoses based on validity data, had about 14 valid diagnoses. So if you divide 14 by 292, you get about 5%. That's why 95% of DSM was invalid from the start. And the leaders of DSM admitted as such. They didn't claim that it was all valid. They didn't even claim it was mostly valid, because it isn't. The only thing they claimed was that it's reliable. So let's talk about that a minute. We always have reliability versus validity. Reliability means that we can agree on the diagnoses, that there's a consensus on how to define things. And that's what DSM has claimed, and that's what a lot of supporters of DSM support and say is good about it. Firstly, I'm going to argue in a bit maybe that it's not anywhere near as reliable as people think. But secondly, even if it is reliable, suppose that we reliably define the phrase unicorn, and we can all agree on how to define a unicorn. But since a unicorn doesn't exist, that's a useless thing to do. We have consistency about false diagnoses, consistency about invalid diagnoses, consistency about things that do not exist, certainly have not been proven to exist, and we can't really even claim exist in a real way. Now, we could have philosophical discussions about what we mean by existence. And there are some people, many people in the DSM world, who argue, for instance, that we're not talking about carving nature at its joints, which is a quote they like to use. were talking about natural kinds, real things in the world of nature. I disagree with them, but that's a larger philosophical discussion. But the fact that people go there also brings up another aspect of DSM, which is that it's based, in my view, on a basic postmodernist philosophy. What do I mean by that? I mean that it's based on a relativism about truth, a skepticism and cynicism about science. That's why science is a lower standard than pragmatism. Pragmatism just means, put differently, social construction. For those of you who've heard that, you know what I mean. For those of you who haven't, this is a phrase in philosophy and in the humanities. The idea that many cultural views are social constructions means that it's what our society agrees to think about something. That may be different from another society, and it may be different from our own society at a different time in history, before or after us. We're not claiming that the way we think about political issue X or social fashion Y is the way that all human beings should think about it. It's what our society thinks about it now. And in essence, I think that's what a lot of DSM is. I think that the DSM leadership, the American Psychiatric Association for the last 50 years, mainstream American psychiatry has engaged in social constructionism. It's made up its DSM diagnoses as what's socially acceptable to us in American psychiatry as a profession in the late 20th century. And that's all it is. It doesn't claim, and it shouldn't, that it's some reality outside in the world. But the problem with it is we don't tell people that. We don't say, here's my diagnosis of so-called attention deficit disorder, and I just made it up, and it's a social construction of our current profession. But we don't really know if it really exists in the biological world. Here, take Adderall for the next 20 years. We don't say that. We just say, here's ADD and here, take these amphetamines. The public assumes that we mean that these diagnoses are real, but they're not for 95%. Now, there is the 5%, let me just mention, schizophrenia, manic depressive illness, which is not the same thing as bipolar. We'll talk about that later. Recurrent severe unipolar depression, which is not the same thing as major depressive disorder. We'll talk about that later. Obsessive compulsive disorder, autism, which is not the same thing as the so-called autism spectrum. We'll discuss that later. There are a number of different PTSD, borderline personality, antisocial personality, eating disorder, substance abuse. There are a dozen DSM concepts that are valid, that have been proven valid scientifically. I am not saying that mental illnesses in general are invalid or unreal. In fact, I'm saying the opposite. They're very, very real. It's just that they're not captured well by DSM 3, 4, or 5. And the majority of DSM 5 diagnoses are not real. They're social constructions. Now, the critics of DSM are postmodernists, many of them. What you see on the internet, the so-called, you know, anti-psychiatry people, what you read on websites like Mad in America and other places, most of those people don't think that psychiatric diseases exist. Or if they exist, they think they're extremely rare or narrow. They don't think psychiatric drugs are effective at all. Or if they're effective, they think they're effective very rarely. They even criticize very proven drugs that are life-saving, like lithium. They criticize the pharmaceutical industry, but lithium has never been developed by any pharmaceutical company and has been generic from the very beginning. It's not about money. It's about their anti-drug, anti-disease, anti-biological, postmodernist ideology and belief system. Those are the fanatics who are out in the world who are anti-DSM critics often. But the ironic thing is that the mainstream psychiatry also is postmodernistic, just like its critics. It's just that this postmodernism is unconscious and it's often not even appreciated. And I don't think most people are aware of it within psychiatry, that the leadership of the field and the field itself has taken this very relativistic, skeptical of science turn. And so what I'm advocating for is that we make DSM scientific, really, not that we pay lip service to it, but that we base DSM criteria only on scientific matters, not caring about social construction, not caring about what the population of the United States or anywhere thinks, not caring what the patients think, not caring what the doctors think, not caring what profession thinks, only caring what nature thinks, caring about what the truth is. That's the only scientific ethos. What's the truth? Not what does society around you think about it. Society may hate you for it. Like Galileo, you may be executed for it. Maybe that's a little dramatic, but in these days we don't execute people, but we do make them suffer in other ways that are much less painful physically, but may still be harmful. I think it was Emerson who once said that society punishes you for improving it. So it hasn't been easy. In fact, hardly anyone within psychiatry has spoken out against DSM in any clear way in the last 50 years. And the critics outside of psychiatry who criticize it have done it for the wrong reasons, these postmodernist attitudes. People often do the right thing for the wrong reasons, though. So I'm fine with the criticism of DSM as long as we understand that some of the solutions that a lot of these critics are offering aren't legitimate, in my view, because, again, they're postmodernistic. So that brings us to the question, what kind of solutions can we have? What would be an alternative? Well, one alternative, and in my view, the best, is simply to drop DSM altogether. We don't need a DSM. Only psychiatry has a DSM among all physicians. Take all the dozens of medical specialties. Nobody else has a DSM, meaning there's no other medical group, no other specialty in medicine where the administrative professional organization like the American Medical Association, you know, or the American College of Cardiology, they're not the ones that define what heart attack is or what coronary artery disease is or what hypertension is or what diabetes is. They're not the ones who define it. It's the researcher experts in each of these conditions that define what these things are. And they don't do it with 10 out of 12 criteria, which you have for X weeks and you don't have for others. They don't make it a list often. Sometimes they do, but usually they don't. They just describe it in the standard medical textbooks, or they describe it in the scientific research studies. So how does an internal medicine physician know that somebody has asthma or diabetes? Or how does he know that somebody has ulcerative colitis? Or how does he know if someone has, I don't know, gout? It's not by asking the American Medical Association to tell him what the criteria are. He looks it up in a textbook. He learns it in school through textbooks. Or he might read some scientific articles about it. And who writes the textbooks and the scientific articles? Not the chairman of the Department of Iowa, or not the chairman of the Department of Medicine in St. Louis. It's the researchers who actually study those specific topics. They write the textbooks. They're the ones that can tell us what the best current knowledge is about it. Why doesn't psychiatry do the same? You open a psychiatric textbook, you get nothing but DSM criteria. We should throw out the DSM criteria and base our diagnostic definitions or diagnostic ideas on the best knowledge of our time now. And that's established by research and scientific studies, not by social constructionist opinions about what's going to give us more insurance reimbursement, what's going to lead to more or less lawsuits, what patient advocacy groups like or don't like, what the majority of psychotherapists think about X, Y, or Z. We shouldn't care about any of that. We should just look at the best scientific research. That's what every other discipline in medicine does. And there's no reason why psychiatry shouldn't do it, especially if we claim parity, as we like to say, parity, equalness with the rest of medicine. Well, we shouldn't be equal if we're not working in an equal way. We're not putting science first. We're not putting research definitions first. We're putting pragmatic social constructions first. Now, one approach to doing this, besides dropping the DSM then, is to have an alternative definition, which would be clinical research diagnostic criteria. I mentioned to you that in the 1970s, there was a thing called the Research Diagnostic Criteria, RDC, where about a dozen or so, a little more, psychiatric diagnoses were defined based on validity studies at the time. Some of that's been disproven, but at least they were using the knowledge they had at the time. I've advocated for the concept of clinical research diagnostic criteria. I call it CRDC, where we use clinical research to define our definitions of syndromes. This is different. Some of you might be wondering about the National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH's research domain criteria, RDoC. This is different than that. So just a brief little pause on that. Back in 2013, when DSM-5 came out, the current revision, some of us in the field were very unhappy that basically DSM-4 was being repeated with minor changes, which was the same as DSM-3 with minor changes. So nothing had changed in 40 years, despite a lot of scientific research that supports or changes different definitions that we had. And that psychiatry was essentially standing still in 1980 and not moving forward. We had 40 years of research at the NIMH, which required DSM criteria, research on genetics, on neuroimaging, and on pharmacology medications, most of which had either turned out to be negative or failures or ineffective relatively. And those of us who'd been doing that kind of research knew by that point that DSM was part of the problem. In fact, now I think it's the biggest obstacle to scientific progress in psychiatry. In 2013, the head of the NIMH, Thomas Insel, put out a blog post a few weeks before DSM-5 was published stating so. This is not just my opinion, but also his, that DSM is invalid scientifically, and therefore, he concluded, would no longer be used by the NIMH for scientific research. So from 1980 to 2013, you could not get an NIMH grant unless you use DSM criteria. From 2013 to now, you can't get one if you do use DSM criteria, at least in the majority of their grants. And so they created as an alternative what they call RDoC, or Research Domain Criteria. So DSM is wrong, RDoC is worse. Worse in the sense that it's another made-up set of criteria. It was just an NIMH leader sitting around a table saying, what do we think? Well, they didn't prove it either. These are hypotheses. It's fine to have scientific hypotheses and test them. It's not fine to say this is the right way to think. This is the only way to think. And this is the only way you'll get grant money from a federal-funded agency like the NIMH. So that's why I disagree with them. Besides that, it's neurobiologically based. It's not saying, here are the signs and symptoms, and we're validating them by genetics and course of illness, which is what I'm proposing, which is the traditional view. But rather, it's saying, this is what we know about this circuit in the brain and that circuit in the brain, and that's here's five ways of thinking about that. That's what RDoC is. And then they say, okay, what kind of clinical symptoms correlate with this? It's working from the brain out to the world of the patient's clinical symptoms, as opposed to working from the world of the patient's clinical symptoms into the brain and the body. In all of medicine, for the last 100 years of scientific progress, we've always worked from the patient's clinical symptoms into the body. And you can't just start out with body speculations and expect to define the real world of illnesses. That's just not the way it works. The NIMH is wrongheaded about this. It's not being clinical. It's not looking at signs and symptoms, because NIMH made the mistake of believing that DSM 3, 4, and 5 failed because clinical research failed. So NIMH instead said, okay, let's do biological research instead. That's wrong. It's true that DSM 3, 4, and 5 failed, but it's not because clinical research failed. It's because they didn't base it on research of any kind, clinical or not. It was just a social constructionism. So the NIMH was right for the wrong reasons again, right that DSM is scientifically invalid, but wrong about why it's invalid. It's actually a simpler issue. It's not complicated. What we have to do is do what the rest of medicine does, base our clinical definitions on clinical research. I'm not opposed to biological aspects to that, but not just limited to biological research, clinical and biological research. Research, science, and that's not what DSM 3, 4, or 5 have done. I'm not getting any chats from the live stream. That's okay, but if you do want to put some up, I can talk to it. I'm going to speak for maybe another 5 or so minutes, and then we'll end this podcast. I do want to say a few more words about social constructionism and how it's played out in our terms of our current problems. An aspect of the background to DSM-3 in 1980, which was led by Robert Spitzer, like I said, was that he had been involved a few years earlier in 1973 with taking homosexuality out of the psychiatric diagnostic definitions in the prior revisions, so-called DSM-2. Homosexuality was taken out in 1973. Of course, we all applaud that. But I think the take-home message that he took from it, though, is what led to the problems of DSM-3 and onwards. He saw that homosexuality was a social construction. It was put in for social and cultural reasons, and it was taken out for social and cultural reasons. And essentially, he applied that same paradigm to all psychiatric illnesses. We can put them in for social and cultural reasons, and we can take them out for social and cultural reasons. Well, it's true that most psychiatric diagnoses are social constructions. I don't think that's a reason to put them in. I think that's a reason to take them out, like we did with homosexuality. And I think what he missed and what we're missing is this allegiance to validity, this idea that what we put in should not be social constructions, but should be biological, psychological, and social realities, real things. Now, you notice I didn't just say biological. I said psychological and social too. they're all important. A lot of people some people misinterpret me as thinking that I'm just calling for a medical model or biological reductionism. Certainly, it's been wrongheaded to say that DSM is a medical model, like many people say. It's actually an anti-medical model. It's not medical at all because it's not based on science. It's just social construction. But I think that what we need to do is to have DSM be more medical for biological diseases, yes, but also psychological and social for non-biological diseases. We can more clearly identify psychologically caused conditions that really are not medical diseases and not mainly biologically based, like post-traumatic stress disorder or borderline personality or antisocial personality. And we can more identify socially caused conditions, which we don't really understand well right now because we take this vague, so-called eclectic, so-called anti-theoretical DSM approach, which in fact does have a theory, which is this postmodernist relativism. For instance, war causes PTSD. If you want to manage PTSD, yeah, you can try to do it with psychotherapies. We are trying to get better ones. But the best way to do that is to prevent war. And that may sound simplistic, but it's not minor to say that war is a mental health issue, and we're not taking that kind of issue seriously. Sexual trauma happens in 20% of the female population in the United States. That's not being addressed at all in a real systematic way in our society. Of course, many mental health professionals pay attention to it, but again, we're using it in this eclectic way that DSM uses, and patients are getting diagnosed with PTSD, borderline, getting psychotherapy as they should, but often getting many medications, which they shouldn't. That's a social issue, and we should be addressing that preventively as well. I do have one question that came in on the chat. What are some resources for valid diagnoses that clinicians can use? So we validated, me and researchers that I work with, validated this concept of clinical research diagnostic criteria, CRDC, in a paper and a series of papers that we wrote in relation to bipolar illness. So we have created CRDC for bipolar illness, clinical research diagnostic criteria for bipolar illness. And what I propose is that we should have the schizophrenia researchers do the same thing, and the depression researchers do the same thing, and the anxiety researchers do the same thing, and the eating disorders researchers and the substance abuse experts, let them each create CRDC for their definitions. And that can be used for research. We don't need to impose that on all clinicians as something that they have to follow. Clinicians do not mean to be told what to do in a top-down, Stalinesque kind of way, where you're forced to believe a certain thing. That's not the way science works. That's not the way medicine works. Psychiatry is unscientific and unmedical in being that way. As a clinician, you don't need to be told what to do. You need to be asked, you need to be not told, but expected to use the best scientific evidence that's out there. And that means studying textbooks and studying the research literature and applying your best clinical judgment based on that. So those are your best resources. You don't need to go to one place. I already mentioned the textbooks and scientific studies, and there's plenty of studies on the validity of lots of diagnoses. And that can be, if you have a hard time finding that, then once we get rid of DSM, we can write some good textbooks and put it all there for you as well. But like I said, for now, the CRDC is one option, as in bipolar illness, at least we've shown that it's feasible and it can be done for other conditions. Maybe a final point I'd like to make is that the original DSM-3 made the claim that reliability would lead to validity. And that's some of the defense that people make of DSM. Well, reliability has not led to validity. Reliability does not necessarily lead to validity. Reliability can be totally invalid if you're defining things well that don't exist, like a unicorn. You don't have to focus on reliability. You can validly define things and actually be unreliable about it. Appendicitis is a thing, and surgeons and doctors disagree frequently on the diagnosis of appendicitis. The reliability is low. So of course it'd be nice to get high reliability, but that's not the most important thing. The most important thing is validity. Your definitions have to be right. Then we can try to make them consistent, not the other way around. So what I'm arguing for is essentially turning around the whole philosophy of DSM. Instead of reliability being most important and leading to validity, which it doesn't, validity should be more important, and we should later work on reliability as good as we can, but make sure we're talking about valid conditions. Let me say one more thing about why reliability did not lead to validity. when DSM-3 came out, it had so much influence. It was so popular. It led to more interest in continuing it. So DSM-4 was basically unchanged. And the leader of DSM-4 told his committees to make as few changes as possible and as small as possible. That's the exact opposite of science. When you do scientific research, you don't say to yourself, let me keep everything the same, maybe make a small change if I have a lot of evidence for it. No, you have to try to change things to whatever is right based on whatever evidence you have. And the fifth edition didn't change it much, the fourth either. In other words, people say DSM is like a dictionary where we can agree on definitions of things, but they also say it's a Bible. Well, the problem is the dictionary became a Bible. We started worshiping the dictionary. We started acting that these definitions are godlike and we should never change them. We haven't changed the definitions of personality disorder since 1980. We haven't changed the basic definitions of major depressive disorder, which is an invalid diagnosis, bipolar illness, generalized anxiety disorder, which is another invalid diagnosis. Since 1980, attention deficit disorder mostly too, which I would argue is invalid, which would be another podcast episode. But we haven't changed these things since 1980. Well, no other branch of medicine uses exactly the same definition since 1980 with hardly any change at all. The basics can be the same in some things, but there's always some change. And we're reluctant to change DSM definitions. You could call it DSM conservatism. The leaders of DSM task forces actually tell the task force not to change things. And so that's how reliability has not led to validity. Instead of agreeing on definitions and changing them based on validity research, we've agreed on definitions and refused to change them based on validity research, just because we like the definitions, because people are worried about what would happen in psychiatry if DSM was changed, since everybody's so used to it, everybody's so dependent on it. We might add that it's the majority of the American Psychiatric Association budget. If you end DSM, the APA would have to live on a much smaller budget, which would mean losing employees and decreasing what it does. That's actually a big economic rationale for DSM, for that a lot of people, consciously or unconsciously, within the APA have promoted in the last few decades. I think the APA needs to figure out other ways to fill the budget gap than to make up a diagnostic system that's invalid and false, and that it is not really good to do that. We really need to just focus on what's best. Yeah, I think the APA has always had its heart in the right place in terms of focusing on what's best for the profession and for people with psychiatric illnesses. But I think there's been some groupthink and tunnel thinking in relation to DSM over the last few decades, and a failure to really admit that this emperor has no clothes. So I'm going to finish up my podcast here today with just that suggestion, the idea, the basic idea, that validity has to be first, and that putting reliability first instead is wrongheaded and hasn't actually led us to have more validity, and it's not the right way to go. It's really important that our diagnosis be valid, and I think that's what we need to be doing. And because of all the political, economic, and social conflict around DSM, I think it would be better just to not have DSM anymore, no more revisions, and just to do what the rest of medicine does, which is to base on medical texts and research. If you don't like that, clinical research diagnostic psychiatry would be a backup minimalist option. Finally, people will say, what about insurance coding? We can use ICD codes, International Classification of Diseases, just like all the rest of medicine does. We don't have to have a separate coding system for psychiatry. And even when you have codes, you don't have to have a list of criteria. None of the rest of medicine does that. You don't have to force every clinician to do it a certain kind of way. None of the rest of medicine does that. You can just say, here's my code for manic depressive illness, but not say how you defined it. You don't have to do that. Here's my code for anorexia. You don't have to say it's because of this or that definition. You can still code it, just like physicians code a broken ankle, and they don't have to say exactly what they mean by that. You don't need the professional organization to tell you how to define broken ankle. I really think that psychiatry is able to do better than this, and that DSM is a major obstacle now for research and for practice to be scientifically legitimate and therefore clinically effective. The two things go together. If you don't have validity, you don't have utility. You don't have efficacy. And we can do better than that in psychiatry. So thanks for joining me on the live stream today. And I appreciate the inclusion of some folks here with chats. And I look forward to seeing you next time.